This week, we turn the spotlight on the hearings into the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Explosive testimony as witnesses reveal what they saw and heard before and on the day of the violent attack. As the lawmakers examine former President Donald Trump's role in the riot, what are the takeaways and consequences for America? And should the rest of the world take note? We'll also discuss energy access in African countries.
Nigeria should stand at an advantage. That should be an opportunity for us to key into that market.
European nations are eyeing Africa's energy sector to replace Russian gas imports. But what about Africa's own energy needs? And what should be done to secure the continent's energy future and meet the domestic demands of African countries? Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome. I'm Haiti Adams. America has a long history of what's been described as primetime politics in the form of televised congressional hearings into political scandals. Now, you may remember some of the really famous ones, like the 1973 Watergate hearings, which saw then-President Richard Nixon step down, the 1987 Iran-Contra hearings, and the 1998 Bill Clinton impeachment inquiry. For several weeks now, a panel of U.S. lawmakers, led by Democrats, have been trying to build a case against former U.S. President Donald Trump and the role he played in the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. They're hoping to convince the American public of the gravity of a conspiracy that led to the deadly attack on the Capitol just 14 days before the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president. And so far, there have been some explosive testimonies from witnesses and insiders about what exactly happened that day, the events that led up to the riot, and who was behind it. We begin with the latest, Tuesday's shocking testimony from a surprise witness. Here's VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
For several weeks now, U.S. lawmakers' public hearings have alleged former President Donald Trump's efforts to undermine American democracy resulted in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Repatriates to fill the house, guys. Come on, let's go.
A multi-part pressure campaign driven by the former president aimed at overturning the results of the 2020 presidential election and blocking the transfer of power. We've shown that this effort was based on a lie that the election was stolen, tainted by widespread fraud, Donald Trump's big lie.
But testimony Tuesday revealed some of the most important details to date. As Cassidy Hutchinson, who worked just steps from the Oval Office, said Trump and his closest advisors, including her boss, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, knew of the potential for violence.
Things might get real, real bad on January 6th.
Bill Brown cowboy boots. He's got blue jeans.
Hutchinson telling lawmakers Trump was fully aware his supporters were armed and would be heading towards the Capitol.
I overheard the president say something to the effect of, you know, I don't effing care that they have weapons. They're not here to hurt me. Take the effing mags away. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here.
Trump has called the committee's investigation unfair, and his Republican allies in the U.S. House criticize Hutchinson's testimony, saying she was repeating secondhand stories. But Hutchinson, who risks criminal prosecution if she lies under oath, detailed Trump's desire to march on the Capitol with his supporters, even though a top White House lawyer warned it was likely illegal.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy. Keep in touch with me. We're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if we make that movement happen.
An argument that culminated in Trump allegedly attempting to take the wheel of the presidential car and fighting his own Secret Service detail.
The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel.
Hutchinson has previously testified that multiple Republican members of Congress sought pardons from Trump for their roles in undermining the electoral process. On Tuesday, she also revealed Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani and her boss Meadows also sought pardons.
Did White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows ever indicate that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
Mr. Meadows did seek that pardon. Yes, ma'am.
The January 6th committee can recommend criminal charges to the U.S. Justice Department. Investigators are expected to resume public hearings in July. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks to VOA's Katherine Gibson there. So how much do these hearings matter to Americans? What are the political and social consequences, especially with the U.S. midterm elections approaching? And what about the rest of the world? Do people care? Should they? Especially in countries that have experienced successful coups, attempts, insurrections, and where power wasn't transferred peacefully. Well, to discuss all these questions, I'm joined in studio by Voice of America, Steve Reddish. He's an executive producer here at VOA's News Center. And joining us via Skype is Piwakushle Mnyandu. He's a professor of African studies at Howard University. He is based here in Washington as well. Gentlemen, a warm welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Steve, I'm going to start with you. So we have seen some interesting and at times shocking revelations come out of these hearings. What, in your assessment, have been the most important and the most shocking revelations to come out of these hearings so far?
The most important was not necessarily the hearing that we heard Tuesday. It was the hearing that we heard the previous week, where the plot to replace the acting attorney general with someone who would have sent out letters and done the kind of bidding that the former president wanted as far as questioning the vote. That is perhaps the most important and the most chilling, that there seemed to be that kind of palace intrigue where the people in charge were going to be replaced with loyalists. However, what we heard on Tuesday, where not just that President Trump knew that people in the crowd, the people in the crowd who wanted to come closer to where he was speaking and be in the on the what's called the ellipse, basically the backyard of the White House, he knew that they were armed and told his people to take down the magnetometers, to allow all of these people who had weapons, who had were reported to have an AR-15s and other guns and knives and weapons that could hurt people, could hurt anybody in the crowd. He said, take down the magnetometers. They're not here to hurt me, quote unquote. To hear that from the witness yesterday, who was extraordinary in many, many ways. And then to hear her describe the conversation she had with the deputy chief of staff about what went on in the car after the speech on January 6th on the ellipse, that the president attempted to commandeer the automobile to be taken to Capitol Hill, and not just that, but the expectation that it had that he was going to go to Capitol Hill, and the frustration that he had that the Secret Service was not going to let him go to Capitol Hill. That was just incredibly shocking. And then to hear somewhat later that once the rioters had penetrated the Capitol, the legal counsel for the president, the president's lawyer, went to the chief of staff and said, they've penetrated the Capitol, they're attacking, what are we going to do? And for the chief of staff to tell the lawyer, he, the president, doesn't want to do anything. I think that cements answers a lot of questions as to what was going on in the White House at the time, what was the president's state of mind, what was the president's intent. And when this all comes out and is given to prosecutors to then take and make a legal case, this is not a legal hearing. This is political theater going on where a committee of Congress that cannot prosecute anybody but can investigate are presenting the facts. What this does is A, gives the Justice Department a roadmap as to where to go down, and also is intended to win hearts and minds of voters, of people out there, as to if people had questions as to what went on, whether or not the president was in charge of this or not. I think those questions are being answered right now.
And I want to talk about that a little more, about who the audience is for this. People, Kushley, speaking about who the audience is, I want to come to you to give us a sense of what you think audiences outside the United States might make of this, and what has stood out the most to you so far from these hearings.
Well, I would say there's a cynical view in this. One view that would be cynical would be one that says, well, ha-ha, you see, even in America, there are problems with democracy. Even in America, there are revolts that that end tragically, that result in the tragic loss of lives. So, in other words, there is no perfection anywhere in the world of democracy. So, which kind of permeates that light on a shining hill imagery that the rest of the progressive world often holds America to. But a more kind of like a realistic view and a more prevalent view, I would say. If you observe African Twitter, is this idea that, well, look, the fact that we even have a commission, the fact that we even have an investigation, the fact that you have people in the high echelons of the former administration being basically roped in at the risk of prosecution, a very real risk of prosecution, and people can and most likely will go to jail. So the second view then is one that says, well, this is good for democracy. This is democracy at work. And in a continent often, especially, I'll talk more about Africa, especially in South Africa, where we've seen a lot of commissions after tragic events, but you don't see prosecution. So there's a view here that says, well, this is good. And what has stood out for me is basically the good actors who are former officials in the administration, but they came in to say, this was wrong, and I saw it. And we can't just be cynical. Perhaps there's a cynical, you know, expectation that, well, if you are scared of prosecution, you would. But some of these people, I would hazard to say, they just saw wrong, and they knew it was wrong, and that's why they're coming up and testifying.
People, Kushley mentioned African Twitter there. Of course, we live in a very visual age, and of course now with social media, people have much greater access to these hearings, even outside the United States. But speaking of visuals, why, Steve, is it so important that this inquiry unfolds this way? On camera, during prime time in some cases, live hearings and steps away from where the riot actually happened.
I'll take, it's important for America is a television country. I mean, television overtook radio back in the 50s and 60s, and it has just kept building and building, and the ability for more and more television channels to exist, both on cable and now streaming, it is what American society is. We are a visual society, and so much of modern American history has played out on television. You know, from the assassinations of the 1960s, they were not necessarily live, but you did see President Kennedy's motorcade going through Dallas. You did see what happened after Senator Kennedy was shot and after Martin Luther King was shot. So all of that has played out on television. So much of American society, modern American society, has done that. The Watergate hearings in 1974 were riveting. They were done in the daytime. There were no primetime, nighttime hearings. They were all done in daytime. And the eyeballs that it drew were was the television audience and how many people got to see it was part of the pressure that was put on the, on then President Nixon to resign, as well as all the other scandals. You know, talk about Bill Clinton and his impeachment. The 9/11 even played out on television, somewhat live. So we're used to this. And if it's not on TV, then many people don't necessarily believe it actually happened. So this is why it's important for the members of Congress to do this, some in prime time, most of it in daylight, but still on television, so that there's a visual record, it is recorded, and as you pointed out, now with social media, it's now packaged in nice, you know, people used to complain that, that news producers and news programs took everything and sliced and diced it into very digestible pieces for a television show. Now it's happening individually on social media.
Pivo Khosle, do people find this riveting? And in the era of fake news and where it's very hard to discern between what is real and what isn't, does the fact that these hearings are playing out on television and, of course, by extension on social media, does that help the believability aspect of what really happened and how the outside audience sees this?
I think it does. I'll agree with this, the view that we're a viral-obsessed generation, and anything can go viral at any time. And so when there are events like this, these hearings that are in real time, even when there is a joke, even when there is a serious moment, a pensive moment, an emotional moment, some of these moments go viral by just one tweet or one submission on TikTok. And so I see, as a professor, I see a pedagogical aspect to this as well. Youth across America in high school, in the social studies class, and I even think, you know, some of my professor colleagues may use it this fall in the American government class to say, here is what accountability looks like. And here is what happens in a commission. And so our students, including, you know, college students, they get a front row seat in a way that they can also curate their own knowledge by sharing the snippets and the viral snippets.
That's interesting. And I want to stay on the issue of optics there. Steve, is there a chance that these hearings could feel sort of, you know, overly stage managed in a way, just because of the calculation that Republicans made to, by and large, not be in the room? But so the nature of the way this is being done, who's on the panel, who's been called to testify, does it have the potential to undermine perhaps the impact, especially among former President Donald Trump supporters?
It may. There are people who will argue that these hearings are not intended to change the minds of President Trump's supporters. This is an opportunity to uncover the facts and deliver the facts to the American people. That said, in the way the committee wants to. Now, the committee has two Republicans on it, and I think seven Democrats. That was all politics as far as the Republican leader appointing Republican members who he knew was going to be a thorn in the side of the Democrats who are trying to present the case. And some of those people were rejected, others weren't, and the Republican leader then pulled all of the Republican members that he appointed to this committee off the committee. So what did the Democrats do? They picked a couple of Republicans who are incredibly Republican. I mean, the co-chairman of this committee, Liz Cheney, her father was the vice president of the United States under George W. Bush and was key in prosecuting the war, the 9/11 war, you know, the war on terror, as well as the war on Iraq. So, and there's nobody more Republican than him. He served President Ford. So this is rock-ribbed Republican people who are now questioning. And if you look, most of the witnesses who are there are Trump supporters, people who are in the administration, loyalists for the president, including some people who've appeared and said, yes, if Donald Trump was the nominee in 2024 for the Republican Party, they would vote for him. These are people who support the party that Donald Trump represents. And they're telling the story of what appears to be an attempted coup. So I think the optics of who is delivering the questions and who are answering the questions is not lost on the public. These are Republicans. These are former supporters of the former president.
Now, people, Kushle, you know, this kind of thing happens all the time in other parts of the world, and we know it happens in certain parts of Africa, where we have seen, of course, coup attempts, successful coups. Lawmakers investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol characterized this as a coup attempt. If you look at it that way, what is the biggest story here for people outside the United States? The fact that this happened or the fact that it failed?
I think for the people outside the United States, at least to my estimation, is that this was a revolt. And a revolt to us in the United States may sound like, if you're following the hearing, something quite tragic, especially when it leads to loss of life and the real possibility, as we will presume here, that there could actually have been a loss or a transfer of power in ways other than democratic. However, the rest of the world is more cynical with this view, I'd say, especially in Africa, where a revolt is simply, you know, people revolting over the price of bread, and maybe it leads to people kind of, maybe a protest there and there, and these are quickly put down. A coup is a coup. A coup is when people go, the anatomy of a coup, there's immediate violence. There is, you know, a seizing of the means of communication. You know, the military is in on it, or at least a significant wing of the military is in on it. So there's actually a hardcore take on what a coup is, at least in the African context. That may sometimes differ from our take on this as an attempted coup, tragic as it may be.
People, Kushi, you're talking about revolts, and in South Africa, you and I know there could be one like every week. There's a protest every week. But Steve, I want to come back to you. This episode in American history and American politics, could it turn out to be a bigger stain on U.S. democracy and the U.S. presidency, perhaps, than Watergate?
Oh, of course. Watergate was mostly about President Nixon's attempt to cover up the burglary at the Democratic National Committee, in which people who are connected to his administration, maybe second or third hand, they carried it out, but the president was the one who tried to cover it up. So it was much more about covering up the crime, whereas here, this is about whether or not former President Donald Trump led an attempted coup in various different ways. One way was by trying to get state electors, a false slate of electors from various different states to be part of the Electoral College. Another part was a pressure campaign on then Vice President Mike Pence to not certify certain states' electors and accept those, the false ones. It was also what I mentioned earlier, the movement of people from within the Justice Department and replacing the Attorney General with someone who is much more inclined to do what the president wanted to do. I believe that in the next hearing or two, we will find out what happened and what was mentioned, whether the military was involved, because President Trump had appointed an acting defense secretary during this period before January 6th. So there are a lot of different things that we have not found out yet. In the long run, this is going to be, I do think this is going to be a much bigger stain on American democracy than Watergate was or Iran-Contra was. I do think, though, that the American people and America will learn from it, and the democracy will become stronger because of this. I'm generally an optimist, and I do think that what is being said at these hearings are being heard by Americans, felt by Americans, and we won't know what action Americans take for another several months until the November midterm elections. But this is very political. There are politics deep imbued in it, but also what the committee is trying to do is say, try and forget the politics. See what happened. Connect these dots. We're connecting them for you. And that's what this committee is trying to do.
Well, we'll talk about see what happened. People, the thing that does seem to be of note in everything that has transpired so far is that the system held. Because as you mentioned earlier, some individuals in key positions did their jobs. They honored their oath. And of course, you can never design a perfect system. But is that a good example of that if you build in enough redundancy, if you build in enough checks and balances, that the system of government can withstand attacks, not only from outside, but also attacks from within?
Well, I'll continue on your engineering terminology then and say, well, if this was a bridge, the structural integrity held, and it was a test, and the bridge held. So, yes, this augurs well for a student of democracy out there, at least to say, well, this is a bad thing that took place. However, almost immediately, though, there's a reckoning. And also the student of politics and good governance out there will say, well, elections have results, right? Elections, the elections make things happen. Would we have this accountability if perhaps the Democrats had not won back the House and the Senate, right? Would we have this commission? I'll leave it to the imagination of your viewers. However, the system held, and we're looking at people actually being held accountable no matter their position in the former administration. And this is good for democracies or would-be democracies out there to learn that we, and also it shows us that in at least in our world, we have a finer understanding and a finer sensibility about democracy. Right. As I've said before, something that we do rightly view this as an attempted coup, whereas in other places there's more a blunt force understanding of what constitutes a coup. So this in itself, this definition in itself, is going to actually help others who are experiencing similar machinations in their countries to say, well, what's taking place here if the Elections Commission is being stacked, if the vice president is being put under pressure? Right. This is actually also a coup.
This is all very fascinating, especially when we ask people to look at their own particular circumstances and how things work in their own countries. But Steve, do you get a sense that the January 6th, the revelations coming out of the hearings have awakened something, anything in Americans about how fragile their democracy is and at the same time how resilient it is too?
To go back to the bridge analogy, yes, the structure held, and now what the committee is doing is trying to plot out where to fill in the potholes. Where are the fragile stress points to the bridge, to the democracy, and how are we going to shore them up? I think that what we're going to find is there's going to be more legislation that comes out about trying to make sure that these exposed fissures don't make the whole thing collapse. The idea that elections have consequences, we're going to see soon, and we're seeing in polling, and polling is really hard to trust nowadays, but we are seeing some movement that this is making an impact, that people are taking this seriously. How many of them will take it seriously, we won't find out until November. Elections boil, so shall we say, since there's so much unrest going on here in the United States. But this is going to be one of those issues that sends people to the polls. Which way they go will depend on which way they see this hearing landing. But I do think it will be a motivator. Usually in midterm elections for Congress and Senate, when the president's not on the ballot, very few people go to the polls. I think this is going to be one of the biggest turnout midterm elections that we've ever seen.
Wow, fascinating. Piwa Kushle, we hear stories about, we talked earlier about those people who withstood the pressure, refused to go along with ideas that were unethical or illegal in the face of relentless pressure. Are there examples in the history of some African countries where we saw these sort of key individuals in high positions who have had to manage the peace, manage supporters who were baying for blood, and manage a peaceful transition fraught with peril? I ask you because you are from South Africa, like me.
Oh. I think I'll start maybe with an example of kind of failure in the 2008 post-election violence in Kenya, where there was a commission and the perpetrators, at least in the upper echelons of the Kenyan administration, were not held to account, at least in the way most had expected. So there is this idea that when we're looking at commissions, that we must reckon with, that they are not a prosecutorial action, that commissions are, as said before, effect finding, and then it's up to the country to hold those responsible to account. And in the case then of South Africa, I think in 2012 we had the Marikana Commission after about 40 miners were killed by the police, and then a commission was held, and we did not see any prosecution. Then later on in 2018 there was a state capture. Parlance in South Africa for basically this outside influence of the government, kind of what they looked at as a takeover. $60 million later, the commission has finalized its report this year, and we have yet to see prosecutorial action related to it. So I'm sorry to be a Debbie Downer here, but commissions are one thing as far as now lessons to be gleaned from this, but prosecution is quite another. In the United States, we have a good example where some prosecution actually took place way before the commission's work began. So we get to see then that you cannot kick the can down the road of accountability.
I was going to add on to that. There is a growing sense in the United States that and as the hearings go on, this feeling, you can see it in some of the pollings, that there needs to be an accounting for. A judicial, a prosecutorial, someone needs to be held accountable for this, someone's. And the what's not being said is, if that does not happen, then that opens the door for this to happen again. So that's one of the, and to prosecute a former president in the United States, it's never happened before. Will our democracy hold? Will that be something that hurts the democracy? That's something that we're going to have to reckon with.
And we will be keeping a very close eye on the story. Piwa Kushle Mnyando and Steve Reddish. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your perspectives. I do appreciate it. And for the latest on these and other stories, you can go to voanews.com. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, rolling power cuts that experts warn could only get worse in coming years. What can be done to turn things around? We'll take a look at the future of energy access in African countries. We'll be joined by Manoj Sinha from Husk Power Systems for that conversation. Stay with us. Straight Talk Africa. We'll be back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. There's a lot being said these days about whether Africa holds the key to Europe's energy crisis fueled by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and whether some African countries are in pole position to increase energy exports to Europe. But what about Africa's own energy needs? Nigeria is Africa's biggest oil producer, but its own citizens are hardly reaping the benefits. Nigerians are feeling the pressure on multiple fronts, serious fuel shortages, rising prices, and a lack of access to electricity.
It has affected me so seriously because I'm a family man. Sometimes after I close work, I do run up and down just to sustain some things for my family. But now it has affected me so seriously because since the morning I closed from work, I didn't go home. I was just here on this queue. And I've wasted the money I was supposed to buy fuel. It's the same money I'm using to feed myself on this queue.
I'm able to get fuel now and we consume the fuel. We have to come back to the queue again and queue for a long period of time. And this is not helping us in any way. So, sir, I actually want to appeal to the government of the day to help us and to see what they can do to help the masses because we are really suffering.
We have increased the price of goods here because of high cost of fuel and diesel. To transport these vegetables here from the farm, the cost of transportation has gone up, and some of my goods here need to be in a refrigerator, and I have to power the fridge with generator using diesel. We don't have electricity here. That's one of the reasons why we have to increase the prices of our goods.
Well, Nigerian economist Hawa Mustafa says the solution should be coming from within Nigeria itself.
So when people talk about lack of refineries functioning, why are we importing as one of the biggest producers in the world? Why is the price, why are we paying so heavily, you know, for subsidy, and the government keeps crying every day that it is unable to continue the burden, so-called burden of subsidy. It all boils down to the lack of planning. It all boils down to the lack of commitment. Nigeria should stand at an advantage. That should be an opportunity for us to key into that market, you know, that openness, that vacuum that will have been created by Russia. We should see Europe, you know, some countries in Europe and other parts of the world, you know, fighting towards Nigeria, looking towards Nigeria for oil.
Well, South Africans have been subjected to frequent power cuts for more than a decade now as the country's power utility, Eskom, copes with aging infrastructure and struggles to meet the nation's growing demand for electricity. Ask any South African these days about load shedding, which has become a part of daily life. Now, load shedding happens when the country's electricity supply is interrupted to relieve stress on the main electrical grid. So power is on in some parts of the country at some time, and out at other times in other parts of the country. And that's to rotate available electricity between all the customers. And we asked people on the streets of Johannesburg how power cuts or load shedding has affected their lives.
When there's load shedding, cell phone networks are also down. So it's not like you can pick up the phone to communicate with someone. So it's just been not the greatest of times, but I guess it's the new South Africa, so really don't have that much of a choice.
It's really frustrating, you know. I mean, I know in high school throughout to university, it kind of could interrupt me studying, and then you end up, like, doing stuff that you don't need to do because, like, now you're trying to pass time. I will say now it's just, like, you know, traffic is a problem, and at home security is an issue. So when there's load shedding, it's, like, that's when the criminals come out to play. Yeah, so safety, I guess.
It's actually become quite a big problem, especially from a business point of view. Obviously, power goes down, everything goes down, and then you have to start again. There's obviously certain things in a restaurant. You can't run anything three-phase off a generator for the space that we have. So it does. It affects business in a big way. We are fortunate enough to be a business with a generator, so it does take the bite out of it. But, yeah, it becomes a pain. I mean, from a personal perspective as well, I mean, it just disrupts your whole life. I had to come outside to use the phone because the signal drops in the area. So, yeah, it's a big problem.
Now, the energy sector is vital to African countries' economic prospects. So what can be done to help people through this crisis now and secure Africa's energy future? To discuss this, I'm joined via Skype from the city of Fort Collins in the U.S. state of Colorado by Manoj Sinha. He's the co-founder and CEO of Husk Power Systems. Now, Husk installs, operates, and owns solar microgrids that provide affordable electricity to communities in Africa and Asia. Manoj, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You know, we've long had this debate about energy poverty. It's one of the sustainable development goals to end that. And the annual report that tracks the world's progress on that score says sub-Saharan Africa is far off track. Over 500 million people are without electricity, not to mention those without reliable electricity. Why are African countries said to be off track?
Great question. So there are a lot of multilateral institutions that committed billions of dollars to bring electricity or reliable electricity to these 600 plus million people who live in sub-Saharan Africa, mostly in the rural parts of these countries. Having said that, in the last 2 or 3 years, only 15 to 16% of that committed money have really been spent to bring these folks out of energy poverty. That's one. Two is the regulation or the policy that government formulates. Historically, it's the centralized grid that are extended for, you know, hundreds of kilometers or miles to reach to the last mile population, but that is not capital efficient. That is a model that worked 100 years ago for developed economies like the United States, because the United States does have a lot more capital. Fast forward that to now, actually, you can build these microgrids localized to a village at half the price that you would incur in extending the grid. So adoption of policy to embrace new methods to bring electricity, and not just electricity, it has to be affordable and it has to be renewable, right? We're all talking about climate change. Why go through this coal route or fossil fuel route when we can leapfrog directly to solar PV and battery and other renewable sources of energy for powering these half a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa? So that's number two on the policy side. And third would be entrepreneurs like us. We need to solve this problem, and we need to solve this problem quite urgently.
Well, you talk now about the urgency, but, you know, when we hear conversations about formulating, adopting policies and then enforcing those policies, it all sounds extremely bureaucratic and time-consuming, as we know how government policy goes. And you may have heard people talk earlier in the show about the impact of the global energy crisis, prompted, of course, by Russia's war in Ukraine. But for many people in many countries, especially across the African continent, this problem predates, of course, the war in Ukraine. People need solutions now. And the work and conversation around switching to renewables also always sounds so far off. People need the lights on now. They need petrol in their tanks now. How do you make the transition in the current crisis?
So let me start by giving you an example. So we started this company in my home state, Bihar, in India. That was 14 years ago. The regulation for mini grids or microgrids came to the fore in 2016. Nigeria took that policy and implemented by the end of 2016. So that's the fastest policy implementation that I have seen since we started the company 14 years ago. So there is no reason why the policies cannot be adopted if it is working in, you know, major population countries like India and Nigeria for other countries as well. And the multilateral institutions like the World Bank and USAID and things of that nature, they can absolutely help implement the best of the world across multiple countries, because they do have presence in all these countries in terms of a lot of initiatives that they drive. So I don't think, you know, it took us 8 years to formulate a policy in India since we founded the company, but it took us less than a year for that policy to be implemented in Nigeria. My hope and goal is to get multilateral institutions to implement such policies in multiple countries across sub-Saharan Africa in less than, let's say, a couple of years. And it is quite possible, because microgrids is the most capital efficient way to provide electricity to people, not just for lighting purposes, but also to help them go towards more automation and run small shops and businesses, which form the basis of any economic activities around the world.
Thank you for that example. It's actually very interesting. I want to look at the broader picture. Now, we do see a number of examples today, of course, on our show. We showed our audience about how Africa's two largest economies, the national grids and the state-run power utilities, have failed, by and large, to provide electricity for both urban and rural communities. Why have more countries not successfully switched to renewables on a large scale? What exactly, besides policy and money, is standing in the way of getting off go?
So definitely capital is a big one, right? These are infrastructure projects. They take time, and you have to inject billions of dollars to make that change happen. And I gave an example of Nigeria, but the World Bank is also driving initiative in the range of $500 million to $1 billion in multiple other countries to bring about this change. Without capital, you cannot really change your infrastructure from what it is today to the infrastructure of the future, which will mean 24/7 power, and it is 100% renewable. And interestingly, the Russian war, which is very unfortunate, has increased the gas prices around the world, right? So let's say back in Q1 of 2022, oil was trading at $60 a barrel, and now it is probably $110 to $120 a barrel. In Nigeria, specifically, earlier part of the show, you talked about a liter of diesel used to cost 325 naira, let's say, in Jan of 2022. Right now, it costs 700 to 750 naira per liter. So economics of solar PV and batteries becomes even more apparent with the gas prices skyrocketing to the level that it is right now. And it is a long-term asset. Once you install a solar PV for electrification, these assets are going to last 35 to 40 years. So in some ways, it is like oil reserve, but it doesn't need fossil fuel. It needs sunshine, and it can generate power for the next 35 to 40 years.
And that's the great thing about many parts in Africa. The sun always shines. Manoj, but do African nations also have mixed incentives here? Because on the one hand, you do here have the potential for decentralized, community-based and democratized power production in African countries. And on the other hand, from a global perspective, you have all sorts of oil and gas that people just keep seem to discover in Africa, and that some might say finally, you know, Africa can cash in on its oil reserves and sell them to the global market. Africa's time has come. Are some African countries essentially being given this message, sell your oil to Europe, but build solar grids at home?
And maybe that is the right way to go. But as you were discussing early in the earlier part of show, if somebody is selling the crude oil to Europe, and they are actually buying back refined oil. So you sell at, let's say, $25 a barrel as a crude oil, and you get back at $80 a barrel refined oil. You are actually losing money for every barrel of oil that you are selling to Europe. So the way to solve that one is, which I don't recommend, is they should have local manufacturing capacity, which is also a problem at least in the countries that we are operating in sub-Saharan Africa. The local economy doesn't have manufacturing capacity. We end up importing almost every piece of equipment from Asia. That is not really helping the economic stimulation of these rural parts of Africa. They have to make those systemic change as well to really have the economy thrive in the long run. And be independent of this oil-based economy like Nigeria is currently and is facing tremendous challenge or headwind in terms of dollar reserve for the country.
Manoj, is there a place for state-run power utilities in Africa's energy future and Africa's energy mix? Or is the era of the state-run power utility over?
I don't think so. It is call it public-private partnership. So microgrid companies like us, we definitely sell electrons to our end customers. But what we really excel in is understanding the customer's needs on an individual basis. So if you have a carpenter shop that owner might have a different set of requirements than a water cleaning enterprise. And that is something that the state discos, as they call it in Nigeria, or distribution companies, are not built to serve that kind of customer-centric view, while we are. And therefore, I see a win-win-win, if you will, without using that term too often. So we are really excellent when it comes to serving the end customers. For example, we have a service level agreement with end customers that if you report a problem, either directly to our electrician or on the phone and on our app, we will fix that problem in less than 1 hour, in less than 4 hours after the report. That is something that discos or distribution companies cannot ever match. So in this case, we can serve these clients really well. We become partners with state-run utility. We can purchase some of the power that they have and can sell in bulk. And therefore, they also make money. Right now, they're always bailed out by government because they constantly lose money because of AT&C losses is how they call it, aggregated transmission and other losses. So we solve that problem. Customers become happy because they're getting affordable power and reliable. We are happy because we have a business that we can take and scale and the capital will flow in. Discos are happy because finally they can actually make profit from this B2B business-to-business relationship. So I think this PPP model really is the way to go. India has done some with the likes of Tata Power and others, and they are showing quite a bit of success.
Manoj, very quickly, is electricity access enough, though? What about opportunities for job creation? What exist? What opportunities are there that go beyond just giving people lights in their homes and businesses and mobile chargers?
Right. So, yes, you can definitely provide, let's say, solar lanterns and things of that nature so that people can use it to light their rooms or house for overnight, like, let's say, 6 p.m. to next morning, 6 a.m. But is that sufficient? It's great to have that because now children can study and people have a little bit longer length of the day to hang out and enjoy the day. But is that sufficient? I don't think so, because this doesn't help the small or MSMEs segment. So, for example, there's a carpenter shop that might have, let's say, two employees and they're building furniture pieces using manual labor. Maybe they're doing 5 furniture pieces per month, right? So they're constrained because they don't have electricity to power a motorized automation to actually produce more with the same staff that they have. So in this case, we finance motorized, let's say, sawmill and things of that nature that they can use to now move from a complete manual to an automated process. They were manufacturing 5 furniture pieces previously, and now they are manufacturing 50 furniture pieces on a monthly basis. So now the problem is not manufacturing, the problem is sales and marketing. So they can hire additional sales personnel to sell those additional 45 units that they're producing. So this is quite catalytic. We have seen this. We serve more than 8,000-9,000 MSME customers across these two continents. And constantly we have seen their income increase by more than 30%. And they're able to hire a couple of additional people in their establishment.
Well, Manoj, I am personally rooting for more happy customers, fewer power blackouts, and, of course, less load shedding. Manoj Sinha, the CEO and co-founder of Husk Power Systems, thank you so much for your time. He joins me there from Fort Collins, Colorado.
Thank you very much.
Well, still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa, we take a look back at the highlights from the G7 summit in Germany as Western nations grapple with the global economic fallout from Russia's war in Ukraine. We'll have that story after the break.
From around the world, let's go.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Leaders of the G7 nations met in Germany's Bavarian Alps earlier this week to discuss, among others, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the global economic crises fueled by the war, vaccine inequity, and climate change. Now, the G7 comprises the world's seven wealthiest countries: the United States, France, Germany, Japan, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Italy. And each year, the country holding the G7 presidency invites partner countries to join part of the summit. And this year there were five, including South Africa and Senegal. Western allies are trying to beat back rhetoric fanned by Russia that it's not Moscow's invasion of Ukraine, but rather Western sanctions that are causing multiple global crises. Anita Powell takes a look back at what came out of the summit.
G7 leaders opened up their summit Monday to emerging economies, inviting the leaders of Argentina, India, Indonesia, South Africa, and the World Trade Organization, among others, to join them in confronting some of the world's biggest challenges, primarily Russia's intensifying onslaught on Ukraine and its global impact. Russian strikes spiked as G7 leaders met, with a missile slamming into a crowded mall on Monday in central Ukraine. Summit host German Chancellor Olaf Scholz condemned Russia's behavior.
Earlier, I very consciously called this a turning point. Because of Russia's attack on Ukraine, all the rules, all the agreements that we have made with each other about the way the cooperation of states have been broken, especially the understanding that borders should not be moved by force.
Ukraine's president virtually addressed the seven leaders Monday morning and asked for more military and development assistance. Volodymyr Zelensky has said he's concerned about the conflict's escalation and possible spread.
I want to address the citizens of Belarus, both civilians and those in uniform. You are being pulled into war, even more actively than in February in the spring months. They have decided everything for you in the Kremlin. Your lives mean nothing to them, but you are not slaves or cannon fodder.
The leaders of the world's largest economies say they also want to compound the economic pain on Russia. One idea they floated is price caps on Russian oil. Essentially, they will refuse to pay above a certain price. Analysts say it's unclear whether that idea will work without the cooperation of India, which has recently bought discounted oil from Russia.
In order to be truly affected, you have to get all the oil buyers, you know, into the club. And while there's great unity among the G7 and a number of other countries, India in particular and China are two big outliers that are buying up Russian oil because they can right now. It's unlikely in my mind that China is going to join in a club like this, given that it's basically adopted a pro-Russia neutral stance on the war. So there will always be leakage then. But you know, a club minus China itself would do serious damage to Russia's financial flows.
This conflict and this issue are likely to dominate as some of these same leaders move from the G7 to the NATO summit, which starts Wednesday in Madrid. Anita Powell, VOA News, TELTS, Austria.
And that is it from us here on Straight Talk Africa for this week. Thank you to all my guests for joining me and our affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa across the African continent. And thank you to you, our audience, for joining me on television, radio, and online. Thank you for always watching and always listening. From our team here in Washington, until the next time, goodbye.